At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
There will come a time, I like to believe, when central bankers aren't going to have to save the global economy. That time, however, is not today. Thanks, Brexit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, June the 30th, Thursday. Great as always to have you along, everybody. You remember how not all that long ago, the American Congress was pretty much paralyzed. The economy was in more than just a little bit of trouble. And the only person who could or would do anything about it was Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed. All right, so fast forward to, today. And that's where the UK is. Both of that country's major political parties are without functioning leadership. Brexit means who knows what for the British economy, but probably nothing good. And lo and behold, here comes once again a central banker to prop things up. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has today's installment of Brexit Uncertainty.
Britain already has a record low interest rate of 0.5%. Today, Mark Carney, governor of the Bank of England, said it may have to be lower still.
The economic outlook has deteriorated, and some monetary policy easing will likely be required over the summer.
Clouding the economic outlook, Brexit, and the acute political uncertainty last week's referendum has caused. The Prime Minister's on the way out, so it seems is the leader of the opposition. Economist Eric Britton of Fathom Consulting finds it all unfathomable.
I don't know who our Prime Minister is. I don't know who our Chancellor is. I don't know if we're in Europe or out of Europe. I don't know if we're going to have another referendum. I don't know if we're going to have another general election. I don't know any of those things.
And neither do any of the businesses in Britain or abroad that may have been planning to invest here. This vacuum could last until there's a new government in place and it's developed a plan for withdrawal from the EU. That could be 6 months of damaging uncertainty, says Simon Tilford of the Centre for European Reform. And that would suit the rest of Europe just fine.
Britain mustn't be seen to be getting away with this. Britain must be seen to be abiding by the rules, and Britain must be seen to be being punished.
He says some European officials and politicians may even hope that Britain has second thoughts about Brexit. But others worry that if Britain slides back into recession, as the Bank of England seems to fear it will, the whole European Union will once again be discredited. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Mark Carney, by the way, the governor of the Bank of England, in case you were confused by the accent, he's Canadian. The global economy being a big place as it is, that Brexit vote is going to play out in a whole lot of ways, including food and the American farmers and businesses who sell into the European market. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
U.S. farmers are facing a lot of scrutiny these days over issues like animal welfare and genetically modified crops. Bob Young is chief economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation. He worries American ag producers could face tougher scrutiny and regulations in the EU without the UK around to push back.
The UK has kind of always been a good moderating voice in the EU. The UK guys are the ones that say, you know, come on, we got to do this. Or, you know, that's stupid. You know, let's get this moved.
Young's talking about the UK's influence within the European Commission, the EU's executive body. The Commission recently extended its authorization of the use of the chemical glyphosate, which UK officials supported. Glyphosate's a pesticide widely used on genetically modified corn and soybeans. Blocking its use could limit U.S. farmers and exporters' access to the European market. Young worries the Brexit increases the possibility of a ban.
If they can decide to ban that, you know, it's like, geez, how are you going to farm? Who knows what comes next?
Then there's the trade deal known as the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, which would do things like lower tariffs on American ag exports to the EU. Joe Glauber at the International Food Policy Research Institute says the UK has been an important advocate for it.
And certainly their exit complicates all the TTIP negotiations, because I don't see how that helps at all in terms of trying to reach any sort of agreement with the EU in the meantime.
But Glauber says the really big question is whether the UK Brexit vote is just the first shoe to drop and whether global markets will see more turmoil. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Today makes it 1 year exactly that some in Congress tightened the leash on the Export-Import Bank. It's not really a bank at all, technically, in the traditional sense. It's a government agency that lends money to foreign companies to help them buy American products. It is, however, that part about our government lending money to foreign companies that irks those same lawmakers. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
A year ago, John Murphy was working around the clock, lobbying hard to keep the Export-Import Bank open.
I spent 8 or 9 hours testifying before the Senate Banking and House Financial Services Committees.
Murphy is a senior vice president at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He says the chamber is still lobbying. Congress finally did reauthorize the Export-Import Bank, but still hasn't confirmed a new member on its board. Without that, the bank can't make loans over $10 million. Putting big international deals in jeopardy. Murphy tells Congress,
at stake are tens of thousands of American jobs.
But critics say these loans are corporate welfare. Veronique de Rougy is an economist at George Mason University.
The game is rigged. If you're a big company, you get a handout from the government. It's crazy.
De Rougy says that's why corporations are lobbying so hard and making campaign contributions. But they do have a potent message, says Peter Cohn, a research analyst with Height Securities. He says when members of Congress are told jobs might be lost in their districts, they have to listen.
And they hear from these companies that if you take this program away, these are jobs that could be lost.
Cohn says he understands it might look like corporate welfare, but if foreign buyers can't get big loans from the U.S. Export-Import Bank, they'll take their business elsewhere. Other countries have their own export-import banks and are happy to loan them lots of money. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
What's that? Wall Street on Brexit plus 7? Oh, please, like it never even happened. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're out this week with the third wave of the Marketplace Edison Research Survey, our poll, getting some different takes on how people feel about the economy overall and, more relevant, their personal economy. Anxiety is generally up over the last time we did this, March it was. Also, the economy looks different depending on where you live. In this case, cities versus the suburbs or rural areas. And it turns out that the suburbs aren't as economically stable as you might think. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
Silver Spring, Maryland is a suburb of Washington, D.C., but the two kind of blend at the border. It still feels like an urban area by the time you get to the Unity Barber Shop, especially with the speakers pumping out music to draw in customers. Owner Ali Salam definitely feels like the area is urban, but many of his loyal customers trek in from the suburbs.
I can see that the economy is getting better. I see how people's pockets fluctuate. I see hundreds of people a week in here. And through this, we see hundreds of people.
And he's got a pretty good way to measure how the economy is doing, how often people come in for haircuts, whether they are looking for a job, interviewing, or maintaining a job.
All three stages of someone's economic struggle or interaction is involved in grooming in some sort of way. Anybody that's worth their salt.
And based on that metric, he says things are getting better. But in his chair today is Reggie Mack, who lives further out in Columbia, Maryland. He says out in the suburbs, things are getting a bit tight. Mack says he makes an above-average salary as a car salesman, but he's not living as well as he used to.
When you start noticing the simple things harder to pay for, cable, the haircuts, and things that you took for granted that you just did without thinking, it's not that way anymore.
More than half of the suburban residents we surveyed said good jobs were difficult to find near home. And people in the suburbs were less likely than their urban counterparts to feel they'd find a good job within 6 months if they lost theirs. That matches up with the research of Elizabeth Kneebone at the Brookings Institution.
There are more lower wage jobs, and lower wage jobs are becoming a larger share of the economy. That, you know, even if you're working full time, it may not be enough to get your family above the poverty line.
And even for those who are holding on, like Reggie Mack in the busy Silver Spring barbershop, their grip on the middle class lifestyle can be precarious. He says earlier this year, he had to go on disability after a surgery and almost lost his apartment.
Those 2 months, I was in the eviction hearing twice.
According to Kneebone at Brookings, there are now more people in poverty in the suburbs than in the big cities that anchor them. Part of it, she says, is that the poor are being priced out of urban areas and moving further out.
But I think the much larger piece is this downward mobility. You know, longer-term residents who've slipped down the economic ladder over time, who may have always been suburban, but who are now poor.
Especially when you think about how many families in the suburbs had their homes and jobs threatened or lost during the recession. Mack has a warning for those who feel comfortable in the veneer of stability in suburban life.
If you don't have 2 months of rent put back, you're a paycheck away from being out. You're a paycheck away from being in the street.
And having come a bit too close for comfort himself, he knows. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
How anxious are you about your personal economy? You can take our quiz, calculate your score, figure out where you fit into our Economic Anxiety Index. You can do it at marketplace.org. Along with virtual reality, artificial intelligence, AI, is one of the hot topics in tech of late, how to deal with it and how to interact with it. Up in Vermont, the Terrasim Movement Foundation is working on a different kind of AI, where the A is slightly less artificial and the I comes from you, your memories, your thoughts, your feelings, uploaded to a database and programmed into a digital you. Disconcerting, perhaps, also perhaps not too far in the future. Bruce Duncan is the managing director at the Terrasim Movement Foundation. Bruce, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Kai.
Tell me about the Terrasim Movement Foundation, would you? What is it that you all do?
Well, the Terrasim Movement Foundation is a private nonprofit research foundation in northern Vermont. And our primary charge is to explore the possibility of using people's life story information, their memories, their attitudes, beliefs, anything that's like in a photograph or video or maybe a journal, uploaded to a computer, and one day can that information be used to reanimate their personality? For example, you may be able to upload your personality into your smartphone.
Tell me more about this LifeKnot project. I mean, you have an actual, it's not, well, I suppose it is a sentient kind of a robot, right?
Right now, we have Buna 48, who is what most people would recognize currently as like kind of a chatbot sentient level of AI. But nonetheless, it makes use of a person's mind file. In this case, the mind file of a specific person. Her name's Buna Rothblatt. She volunteered to undergo, you know, 80 plus hours of really pretty in-depth interviews about her life and about her childhood, about her experiences growing up as an African-American female in the United States. And that information is what provides the raw data for the programming and algorithms that were developed to create an interactive or social android. On the hardware side, David Hansen did a nice lifelike laser scan of the human subject. And that information allowed us to create a very realistic-looking glimpse at what a mind file operating in a robot might look like.
We're going to do a video chat after we get off the phone. And so people are going to be able to see Buna 48 and me interacting. But for those who don't click on that link, what is when people see, I don't even know, do you call it her, it? When people see Buna 48 for the first time, what's their reaction?
There's a range of reactions that people have to robots that look, you know, very human-like. And Buna 48's no exception to that. But on the whole, I would say after about 6 years now of traveling around and talking to people with Buna 48, I'd say the majority of people are just curious.
Just because this is a business and economics program, though, I have to ask you, there will come a day, and I bet it's in the not-too-distant future, when corporate America looks at your project and says, man, we can make a bazoodle full of money in getting in on this.
I think it's only a matter of time. It's not a matter of if, but more a matter of when. Because this is going to be a game changer. Like, we really are going to have people that are going to use this powerful artificial intelligence to do all sorts of things. And I think it's incumbent upon us as citizens and consumers to really become aware of what our rights are and what are the responsibilities of people that use this technology.
Bruce Duncan is the managing director of the Terrorism Movement Foundation. Bruce, thanks very much.
Thanks, Guy. It's been a pleasure.
I mentioned that video chat. If you want to see Buna 48 in action, go over to marketplace.org or check out our Facebook page. We had a nice little chat we did, and it turns out, by the way, she's got a sense of humor.
Anyway, why did the robot chicken cross the playground to get to the other slide?
Coming up,
there's sensitivity about anything that looks like the gringos coming down and telling them what to do.
Amazingly, not the immigration story you might think. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, as of today, 2016 is half over. Dow Industrial is up 235 points today, 1 3/10%, 17,929. The NASDAQ regained 63 points, 1.3%, 48.42. The S&P 500 climbed 28 points, again, 1 3/10%, 2,098. For the year so far, at the six-month mark, the Dow is up 2.9%, the NASDAQ down 3 3/10%, the S&P 500, remember, really the most important index, broader market and all that, up 2 6/10%. All right, Handy and Harmon Limited, products from steel tubing to the blades and deli slicing machines, shaved off 0.25%. I love my job. The L.S. Sterrett Company, 5,000 products for industry and consumers, up 1 1/4% today. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.48%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Grocery store shelves in the great state of Vermont are about to look a lot different. A new law there is going to require all food labels to say whether products contain genetically modified ingredients. It's the first time a state has done that, and as you might well imagine, there have been some fireworks about the law. It goes into effect tomorrow, and its effects will be seen far and wide. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains.
First, producers haven't just been sitting around. They've been preparing. Michael Gruber of the Grocery Manufacturers Association says some, like Campbell's, have been prepping compliant labels. Others are like Coca-Cola, which has signaled it may pull some of its products out of Vermont.
We also have member companies that are reformulating their ingredients to use non-GMO ingredients or organic ingredients to try and avoid that label.
That label, Gruber says, is intended to scare away customers from GMOs, which are perfectly safe. University of Vermont's Jane Kaladinsky disagrees. Not about the safety, about the labels.
Labels are not going to serve as skull and bones or warning labels for individuals.
Kaladinsky has researched the effects of such labels on Vermont shoppers. She says while some will avoid GMO foods, others embrace them, and plenty more don't care. Kaladinsky says research shows customers expect products with GMOs to be priced lower.
Their pocketbook will decide where the marketplace should be, and that's as it should be in a competitive marketplace.
Jason Lusk teaches food economics at Oklahoma State University. He says the labels can put people off, but things like a well-known brand can help offset the effect. It's too early to tell how things will shake out, but wide action is underway. Most producers can't make region-specific labels.
It's not economical for them to make changes only for Vermont, so we have a small state that's going to impact our food labels all across the country.
So expect to start seeing them wherever you are. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the people behind the Oscars most famously, is working on becoming more diverse in a year where the Oscar ceremony itself was glaringly not. 683 specially invited people have become the newest members of the Academy. This year's class is 46% female, 41% people of color. But With the exception of Fox, which has announced an incoming studio head who is a woman, four of Hollywood's five biggest studios are all run by men. So, Sally Herships asked the obvious question. Is increasing diversity at the Oscars going to change the business of making movies?
It's really hard to make a movie.
Oh, it's impossible. It's impossible to make a movie.
Minette Louis is president of Game Changer Films, which does something that by industry standards is really unusual. It finances movies directed only by women. But she says outside of that safe bubble, the vast majority of films get greenlit by men, white men.
And they have the power to make or break stars.
Which has created a problem. We are more likely to identify with and support people who look like us. Louis says it comes from what's called group bias. So she says the makeup of the Academy doesn't really matter until the people in charge of financing and hiring get on board with diversity.
If people of color don't get cast in these big movies and supported with marketing dollars, you'll never make stars out of them.
Lin Chen is an actress. She's also Chinese American.
You know, last night I was watching Kung Fu Panda 3.
Kate Hudson plays Mei Mei, and Jack Black plays the panda. Jen says all this focus on diversity is opening her eyes.
I was realizing, wait a second, is this whitewashing? How is Kate Hudson playing Mei Mei? How is that happening?
Sharon Waxman is editor-in-chief of TheWrap.com, an industry site covering Hollywood. She says the reason is simple.
The problem is, in the power structure of the studios, it's overwhelmingly white and it's overwhelmingly male.
Waxman says the industry as a whole needs to change, or the Academy won't be able to continue bringing in diverse members. There won't be enough who have the necessary experience. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Donald Trump has been campaigning in New Hampshire today. Trade, once again, was the focus of his remarks. Mr. Trump has been clear about how he feels about this country's southern border. But Mexico has a southern border of its own, which is also of interest in the United States. The U.S. is spending millions of dollars to help Mexico secure its porous border with Guatemala. Yet a thriving black market in oil, food and weapons exists. Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Madelon went down to have a look around.
To set the scene, let's go to the Mexican side of the river that separates it from Guatemala, Rio Suchiate.
Cucho!
We're on a raft, one of dozens, that ferries people and goods back and forth all day.
Corn, beans, rice, oil, eggs.
Commodities that cross this border, unregistered, no taxes, a floating black market of underpriced goods.
Man, it's too important. It's too important because a lot of people eat from this job.
That's Carlos Mejia. Deported, he says, from Maryland 6 months ago. His rafts go under a legal border crossing, a bridge that spans the river.
Any of these days, police or the government try to come and close this, this is going to be a big trouble.
That's unlikely. It's widely believed that police get a cut of the action. Mejia has the arms of an athlete from lifting cargo, human beings, packages he doesn't know the contents of, onto his raft. And that is one sound of commerce between Mexico and Guatemala, the sound of recently hatched chickens flailing away in a cage that's just been brought to this Guatemalan river town from Mexico. This is El Carmen, Guatemala, an official border crossing with a bridge that links both sides. Yet the vast majority of imports from Mexico cross on the river below that bridge, and authorities in both countries turn a blind eye. Back on the Mexican side, I'm driving with Benjamin Lopez Santiago. He lives beside the border. He says more than food and clothes are moving here. From a .22 caliber to an AK-47, you can get weapons here.
Economica y de calidad.
Good quality at a good price. He says there's a colloquial name here for this kind of illegal trade, the ant trade.
El contrabando hormiga, que se llama.
But he says it's more like an elephant, given the volume.
Es un elefante.
All this takes place as Washington's committed at least $100 million to help Mexico tighten its border with Guatemala. That after unprecedented numbers of unaccompanied children from Central America arrived on the U.S. border in 2014. But clearly, there are holes on that border. It's easy to enter Mexico illegally, says this Mexican immigration agent. She agreed to speak if her identity weren't revealed for fear of retribution from her superiors. She arrived in uniform, showed her credentials, and arrived with a trusted go-between. We don't have the resources to seal the border, she said. The U.S. has raised objections that Mexico hasn't stopped the river traffic, says Adam Isaacson at the Washington Office on Latin America, a research group.
There are some pretty fundamental disagreements right now about how deeply the Mexicans want the United States involved in the southern border.
And Isaacson says the river is a perfect example.
There's sensitivity about anything that looks like the gringos coming down and telling them what to do. If there was less sensitivity about that, there wouldn't be rafts still crossing the river right now because the Americans have made very clear their alarm about that.
And Carlos Mejia, the man we met on the raft, he says governments may be upset, but that here economy trumps politics. People need to survive.
It's not only 100 people work here. It's thousands of people.
And he says people love the status quo, an unpatrolled river saving time and a lot of money. In Tapachula, Mexico, I'm Lorne Matalon for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, in which Jeff Bezos, being a billionaire and all, can do pretty much whatever he wants and people go, oh, okay. Bloomberg News has a story up about the new headquarters that Bezos' company, Amazon, of course, is building in Seattle. Here's the tidbit. Out front, there are apparently going to be three 100-foot-tall biodomes filled with more than 300 plant species from around the world. And I'm just going to quote Bloomberg here because they pretty much nailed it. Quote, Amazonians will be able to break from their daily labors to walk amid the greenery along suspension bridges and climb into meeting spaces resembling birds' nests perched in mature trees. Me? I'm good with a conference room. All right, so here we go on Brexit plus 7. It goes like this. The Dow up 235, 1.3%. The NASDAQ up 63, 1.3%. The S&P 500 up 28, 1.3%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.